content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the November 21st, 2025 issue of The Week. The cover drawing this week has the Democratic donkey. He's at a nice restaurant sitting at the table with the empty plate. He's got a glass of red wine by him. He's got a startled look on his face. And the reason is that his waiter is House Speaker Mike Johnson, dressed in a tux with a kind of devilish grin on his face. He's just showing the main entree. He's pulling off the lid, and it's a dead skunk. The headline is, "Hard to Swallow, Why So Many Democrats Think the Shutdown Deal Stinks." That is our first main story. We'll start right there. Democrats fume over shutdown deal. What happened? The Democratic Party was racked by infighting this week after eight senators in its caucus struck a deal with Republicans to end the longest government shutdown on record, a deal that failed to secure the party's primary goal. For 40 days, Democrats were united in refusing to reopen the government unless Republicans agreed to extend soon-to-expire enhanced subsidies for the millions of Americans who get health insurance through the Affordable Care Act. But cracks began to emerge among Democrats as shutdown pain mounted, with about 1.4 million federal workers missing paychecks, food aid for some 42 million Americans put on pause, and thousands of flights canceled due to air traffic controllers calling in sick rather than working without pay. The eight caucus moderates said that with Republicans refusing to budge on the ACA subsidies, they had to act. Waiting would only mean more harm, said Senator Jeanne Shaheen, Democrat from New Hampshire. The resulting spending deal will fund the government through January 30th, pay for certain functions, including food assistance and veterans affairs, through September, and reverse the Trump administration's attempted shutdown layoffs of some 4,000 federal workers. Our long national nightmare is finally coming to an end, said House Speaker Mike Johnson. Many Democrats reacted with fury to the deal. We could have won. The premium increase notices were just starting, said Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat from Connecticut. Giving in now will embolden Trump representatives Ro Khanna, Democrat from California, and Seth Moulton, Democrat from Massachusetts. Senate Minority Leader Charles Schumer, who voted no, of being ineffective and called for his removal. President Trump, who hailed the deal as very good, floated a plan to give the enhanced ACA subsidies directly to consumers. Call it Trump Care, he said. What the editorial said. Someone had to step up and be the grown-up in the room, said the Boston Globe. Democrats figured the shutdown would force the GOP to play ball on the ACA extension, but it was clear they weren't going to crack. And the doomed strategy turned stranded air travelers, unpaid federal workers, and people who rely on government services into collateral damage. Americans need those health care subsidies, but they also need a functioning government. And it was a mistake to pit them against each other. For putting the country first, the defectors are getting the predictable pounding from their party's progressives, said the Wall Street Journal. Schumer and friends are playing a cynical game, as they appeal to the base with no votes while benefiting politically from the shutdown's end. Still, you almost have to feel for Schumer and his need to wrangle with his party's red guards, and his life isn't about to get any easier. The current rage heralds more bitterness to come heading into 2026. What the columnist said. This was a cowardly betrayal, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer, and an appalling mistake both morally and politically. Yes, people were getting hurt, but the Democrats' strategy was working. Polls show that about three-quarters of Americans support the ACA subsidies, and Democrats were riding a wave of support and newfound unity after delivering an election shellacking to the Republicans. But eight Quislings have given an authoritarian regime new life and taught Trump that Democrats will ultimately wilt under pressure. This outcome was inevitable, said Josh Barrow in the New York Times. Shutdowns never yield victories for the party forcing them, especially when that party controls neither Congress nor the presidency. And the progressives who are howling about capitulation right now can offer no plausible account of how they would have done better, because there isn't one. While Democrats lost the battle, they've won a larger fight, said Nia Malika Henderson in Bloomberg. This is the messaging fight over the cost of living, particularly health care. Last week's blue wave showed how salient that issue is. And with enhanced ACA tax credits set to expire next month, Republicans are on the hook to address it. If that doesn't worry Republicans, it should, said Yuval Levine in National Review. Healthcare is the only significant policy issue on which the public trusts Democrats more than Republicans. And with average monthly premiums set to more than double next year for the 22 million ACA enrollees who are losing subsidies, Republicans now own the fallout. Democrats may have walked away from the shutdown with little to show, but what did Republicans get? A few more months of Biden-era spending levels and another health care debate they have no idea how to win. Controversy of the week, affordability. Does Trump have an answer? Republicans face a pair of existential threats as they look ahead to next year's midterms, said Chris Brennan in USA Today. The first is the economy. In exit polls from last week's off-year elections, where Republicans suffered a thorough thrashing, voters cited the economy and cost of living as their top concerns. And in Washington Post ABC News poll taken just before the elections, 71% of Americans said they were spending more on groceries than a year ago, with 59% blaming Trump for rising prices. Republicans' second threat is that Trump refuses to admit there is a problem. Instead of asking for voters' patience, Trump this week dismissed the affordability crisis as a con job by Democrats, insisting that prices are down and that polls showing Americans' economic worries are fake. Of all people, Trump should know the folly of this denialism, said the New York Post in an editorial. By refusing to acknowledge the economic struggles of regular Americans, Trump is making the same mistake as his arch nemesis, former President Joe Biden, and risks dooming his party to the same electoral fate. There are signs that Trump recognizes he hasn't won the affordability battle, said Megan Messerly in My Award in Politico. In recent days, the White House has announced a bevy of policies that, if enacted, may ease the pressure on household budgets. They include plans to send Americans $2,000 tariff dividend checks, a reduction in tariffs on coffee, bananas, and other foods, and an investigation into beef producers for price gouging. Trump's exasperation with public sentiment actually has some foundation, said Matthew Iglesias in Slow Boring. While the price of most products is indeed still rising, annualized inflation was 3% in September, down from 9.1% peak in 2022. Incomes have risen faster than prices over the past 5 years, and it's not actually true that people are less able to afford things than they were in the past. But politics is about perception, said Ben Berkowitz and Mark Caputo in Axios. And Trump, on top of everything, has a terrible optics problem. When voters, rightly or wrongly, feel that they're struggling to make ends meet, it's political insanity for the president to be jet-setting all over the world, throwing Great Gatsby-themed parties at his Florida estate, and demoaning the White House to build a $300 million gilded ballroom. Trump's affordability messaging isn't just out of touch, said Eric Boehm in Reason. It's also inept. If, as Trump posted last week, our economy is booming and costs are coming way down, then why do we need relief checks? And what does it say when payments for struggling Americans are funded via the price-raising tariffs we were told would make all of us wealthier than ever? We're in a dangerous moment, said Jeffrey Blehar in National Review. The affordability crisis has hit young people especially hard, and many believe the American dream, a spouse, a house, the comforts of modern domesticity, is now priced beyond reach. That economic discontent caused young voters to swing to Trump last year, but all he has offered them so far are gimmicks, like a 50-year mortgage that will lock them in long-term debt slavery. Angry and disillusioned, young Americans are increasingly embracing socialism on the left and nihilistic nationalism on the right. If Trump leaves the younger generation as destitute of future prospects as when he retook office, their fury will only grow. Trump is in his final term. Perhaps he might not care. You should. It's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for Imperial Tributes after ESPN reported that the White House has lobbied the owners of the Washington Commanders to name the team's new D.C. stadium after President Trump. That would be a beautiful name, said White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt, as it was President Trump who made the rebuilding of the new stadium possible. It was a good week for misspent youth after an 18-year study of more than 3,000 young Norwegians concluded that those who indulged in regular heavy drinking sessions in their late teens and 20s went on to higher levels of education and income than more abstentious contemporaries. It was a good week for empty hats after the AI-generated song Walk My Walk by Breaking Rust hit number one on Billboard's Country Digital Song Sales Chart. Breaking Rust has more than 2 million monthly listeners on Spotify, despite having no verifiable human footprint, as the San Francisco Chronicle put it. It was a bad week for vulnerable seniors after President Trump shared a satirical website's report that DOGE has ended annual $2.5 million payments to former President Barack Obama for royalties linked to Obamacare. Trump, 79, shared the screenshot with a one-word comment. Wow. It's a bad week for big game hunters after police investigating social media reports of an escaped lion in County Clare, Ireland, identified the beast as Mouse, a large but very friendly Newfoundland dog with a fresh haircut that left a distinctive mane of fur around his head and neck. Police described Mouse as delighted with his recent viral video clip. Finally, it was a bad week for husky masses yearning to breathe free after the State Department advised U.S. embassies around the world that they can deny visas to applicants with certain medical conditions, including obesity, that may require expensive, long-term care at the expense of U.S. taxpayers. The briefing this week is titled The Kavanaugh Stop. Activists say a Supreme Court ruling has given federal agents a green light to racially profile Latinos. What is a Kavanaugh stop? The name derives from a September ruling by the Supreme Court, which by a 6-3 vote lifted a lower court order barring immigration agents in Los Angeles from stopping people based solely on several factors, including race. The original case was brought by plaintiffs who argued agents conducting immigration sweeps targeted L.A. residents just for being working-class Latinos. Such profiling has been barred since 1975, when the Supreme Court unanimously ruled that California border agents who stopped a car because its occupants looked Mexican violated the Constitution's protections against unreasonable searches and seizures. In the L.A. case, a federal judge ruled that agents needed more than a combination of a person's race or ethnicity, the fact that they spoke Spanish or accented English, the type of work they do, and where they were found to justify detaining someone. The Supreme Court's conservative majority reversed the ruling, opening the door. Liberal Justice Sotomayor wrote in a dissent, "To a country where the government can seize anyone who looks Latino, speaks Spanish, and appears to work a low-wage job." The majority issued no explanation for its decision, but Justice Brett Kavanaugh laid out his reasoning in a concurring opinion. What did Kavanaugh say? He said it was constitutionally permissible, and indeed common sense, to target people due to apparent ethnicity combined with other factors, such as speaking Spanish or being at a car wash or bus stop. Being stopped on such grounds is a minor inconvenience, wrote Kavanaugh. Any questioning is typically brief, and U.S. citizens and legal residents will promptly go free. Immigration lawyers and rights groups reacted with alarm to the ruling. The court greenlit racial profiling, said Jennifer Bade, an immigration attorney in Boston. This effectively makes us show your papers, nation, where appearance and language is going to make everyone a suspect. Has racial profiling increased? Residents of Chicago and other areas where the Trump administration has launched an immigration crackdown say roving patrols of federal agents are increasingly stopping anyone who looks Latino and demanding ID. In numerous cases, U.S. citizens have been handcuffed, questioned, and held for hours or even days before agents confirm their status. "We have never seen this type of enforcement on the streets ever," said Mark Fleming, an attorney at the National Immigrant Justice Center. Maria Greeley, 44, a Chicago restaurant worker, said she was zip-tied by three federal agents on her way home from work. She showed her passport but was questioned for an hour by the agents, who insisted she didn't look like a Greeley and called her a liar. "It was terrifying," she said. "I am Latina and I am a service worker. I fit the description of what they're looking for now." How many citizens have been detained? There's no official number, but news organization ProPublica has documented more than 170 cases this year where federal agents held citizens against their will. Some were tackled, beaten, and tased. About two dozen said they were held for more than a day with no chance to call a lawyer or family member. At least three were pregnant, and nearly 20 were children. In many cases, administration officials claimed the detainee had assaulted or impeded agents, but charges were often not filed or cases were dismissed. It happened to Javier Ramirez, 32, an auto shop owner in Montebello, California. He says agents entered his business, wrestled him to the ground, held him at gunpoint, and took him to a detention center where he spent 5 days before being released. Homeland Security said he assaulted officers. Security footage shows no assault, and charges against him were later dropped. How are Latino communities responding? Raids are creating a culture of fear that's causing even citizens to stay home for fear of being detained, said Maria Trujillo, a councilwoman in Downey, California, a heavily Latino L.A. suburb. Many citizens in targeted areas now carry passports everywhere they go, including members of other minorities. "Now the onus is on anyone who's not white, male, and MAGA to prove they belong in this country, said Paul Liu, a Chinese-American in Fresno, California. Homeland Security spokeswoman Tricia McLaughlin insists that ICE operations are highly targeted and calls allegations of racial profiling categorically false. But top Border Patrol Commander Gregory Bovino has admitted his agents consider appearance when arresting someone. One factor, he told a white reporter, is how do they look compared to, say, you? Do citizens have recourse against such arrests? The question of whether agents can legally use race as the basis for a stop isn't fully settled. The Supreme Court ruling was issued through its emergency shadow docket, and lawsuits from plaintiffs who claim their civil rights were violated by racial profiling are working their way through the judicial system and could eventually be heard by the High Court. One suit was filed by Leo Garcia Venegas, 26, a U.S.-born citizen who was detained twice by federal agents while working at construction sites in Alabama. In one instance, he was wrestled to the ground. He told his real ID was fake and held for over an hour before being released. He said the agents did not question any white or black workers. It's possible such a case may produce a different outcome at the Supreme Court, but given the earlier ruling and the deference the conservative majority has shown to the administration, it's not considered likely. In the meantime, the indiscriminate stops are having what activists believe is the desired effect, spreading fear. I cannot work in peace anymore, said Garcia Venegas. I am always nervous. Moving into the best columns, first two come from the U.S. Why I had to resign as a judge. 40 years after President Ronald Reagan appointed me as a federal judge, I'm resigning from the bench, said Mark L. Wolf. President Trump's relentless assault on the rule of law is so deeply disturbing to me that I can no longer adhere to judicial restraints on public comments. Trump is perverting justice, prosecuting political adversaries like Letitia James and James Comey on flimsy charges, while pardoning violent January 6 rioters and protecting allies like border czar Tom Holman, who allegedly took $50,000 in a cash bribe in an FBI sting. Trump has fired 18 inspectors general responsible for detecting fraud in federal agencies, eliminated the FBI's public corruption squad, and removed guardrails placed on the sleazy cryptocurrency industry after launching his own Trump coin. Recklessly, this president has frequently denounced and even defied federal judges who have attempted to block his constitutionally questionable executive orders, sparking an unprecedented number of serious threats against them. As he bulldozes limits on his power, Trump has dismantled much of what I dedicated my life to, and I will now join those openly fighting this existential threat to democracy and the rule of law. Usha Vance signed up for this. Vice President J.D. Vance might have disrespected his wife's Hindu faith to please conservative Christians, said Renee Graham, but don't fall for the poor Usha routine. Usha knows she married a political opportunist and shapeshifter who hopes to inherit the MAGA movement, and she's going along for the ride. People felt sorry for Usha after her husband, a Catholic convert, recently told a cheering crowd at a Turning Point USA event that he hoped that his wife would convert to Christianity. When Vance combined that affront with an uncomfortably intimate hug with Charlie Kirk's widow, Erica, the internet exploded with "You in danger, girl" memes. Usha, however, is no helpless dummy. She's a Yale-trained lawyer who clerked for Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts. as the daughter of Indian immigrants, she has stood by her man through his disgusting lies about Haitians eating dogs and cats, and his nativist insistence that only those born in the U.S. are real Americans. Perhaps she views her adjacency to whiteness and power as protection for herself and her biracial children. But as the administration wages war on people of color and constitutional rights, it's America, not Usha Vance, that's in danger. This column comes from Greece. Where ancient blood feuds still claim lives. Greece may wear the mask of the 21st century, said Demetris Ethimachus, but much of it remains stuck in the old ways of petty clan disputes. This time warp was on display recently in the mountains of Crete, where the village of Vorizia became a battlefield in a family feud. One family was apparently building a house too close to the other's turf, and of course both sides were heavily armed. Gun ownership is an addiction in Greece. The house was blown up, and the two sides blasted each other with pistols, rifles, Kalashnikovs, shooting over 2,000 bullets. Two people were killed, several others badly injured, and the wounded survivors had to be rushed to separate hospitals so the families wouldn't start brawling in the waiting room. This vendetta goes way back, and in 1953, one family went so far as to throw a grenade at the home where the other was mourning a feud victim. But nowadays, the warring houses have neither poverty nor illiteracy as an excuse. The killers went to school, have cell phones, watch Netflix, but still think as they did in 1900, when a twisted concept of honor justified shedding the blood of a neighbor. Now the same person who uploads stories on Instagram one day may pull the trigger the next day because somebody's goats accidentally entered his field. Everyone has learned to read, but many still refuse to think. The last word, our in-depth article, The Dawn of the Stupid Age. Technology companies persuaded us that we can outsource our thinking, said Sophie McBain in The Guardian. The cognitive skills we're losing may be impossible to get back. Around 2 years ago, Natalia Kosmina, research scientist at MIT's Media Lab, began receiving out-of-the-blue emails from strangers who reported that they had started using large language models such as ChatGPT and felt their brain had changed as a result. Their memories didn't seem as good. Was that even possible, they asked her? Kosmina herself had been struck by how quickly people had already begun to rely on generative AI. She noticed colleagues using ChatGPT at work and the applications she received from researchers hoping to join her team started to look different. Their emails were longer and more formal, and sometimes when she interviewed candidates on Zoom, she noticed they kept pausing before responding and looking off to the side. Were they getting AI to help them, she wondered, shocked. And if they were using AI, how much did they even understand of the answers they were giving? With some MIT colleagues, Kosmina set up an experiment that used an electroencephalogram to monitor people's brain activity while they wrote essays with no digital assistance, with the help of an internet search engine, or with help from ChatGPT. She found that the more external help participants had, the lower their level of brain connectivity. So those who used ChatGPT to write showed significantly less activity in the brain networks associated with cognitive processing, attention, and creativity. In other words, whatever the people using ChatGPT felt was going on inside their brains, the scan showed there wasn't much happening up there. The study's participants, who were all enrolled at MIT or nearby universities, were asked, right after they handed in their work, if they could recall what they had written. Barely anyone in the ChatGPT group could give a quote, Kosmina says. That was concerning because you just wrote it and you do not remember anything. Kosmina is 35, trendily dressed, and she speaks faster than most people can think. As she observes, writing an essay requires skills that are important in our wider lives. The ability to synthesize information, consider competing perspectives, and construct an argument. You use these skills in everyday conversations. How are you going to deal with that? Are you going to be like, can I just check my phone? She says. The experiment was small, 54 participants, and has not yet been peer-reviewed. In June, however, Kosmina posted it online, thinking other researchers might find it interesting, and then she went about her day, unaware that she had just created an international media frenzy. Alongside the journalist's request, she received more than 4,000 emails from around the world, many from stressed-out teachers who feel their students aren't learning properly because they are using ChatGPT to do their homework. They worry AI is creating a generation who can produce passable work, but don't have any usable knowledge or understanding of the material. The fundamental issue, Kosmina says, is that as soon as a technology becomes available that makes our lives easier, we're evolutionarily primed to use it. Our brains love shortcuts. It's in our nature. But your brain needs friction to learn. It needs to have a challenge. The promise of technology has been to create a frictionless user experience to ensure that, provided we slide from app to app or screen to screen, we will meet no resistance. Technology lets you avoid phone calls, use self-checkouts, order everything from an app, to input your destination on Google Maps and travel from A to B on autopilot. Maybe you stop reading books because maintaining that kind of focus feels like friction. Maybe you dream of owning a self-driving car. Is this the dawn of what the writer and education expert Daisy Christodoulou calls, a stupidogenic society, a parallel to an obsogenic society in which it is easy to become stupid because machines can think for you? It's only software developers and drug dealers who call people users, Kosmina mutters at one point, frustrated at AI companies' determination to push their products onto the public before we fully understand the psychological and cognitive costs. In the ever-expanding, frictionless online world, you are first and foremost a user, passive dependent. In the dawning era of AI-generated misinformation and deep fakes, how will we maintain the skepticism and intellectual independence we'll need? By the time we agree that our minds are no longer our own, that we simply cannot think clearly without tech assistance, how much of us will be left to resist? Start telling people that you're worried about what intelligent machines are doing to our brains, and there's a risk that, in the not-too-distant future, everyone will laugh at what a fuddy-duddy you were. Socrates worried that writing would weaken people's memories and encourage only superficial understanding, not wisdom, but the conceit of wisdom, an argument that is strikingly similar to many critiques of AI. But writing didn't only change how we access and retain information, it changed how we think. As humans, we're very good at what experts call cognitive offloading, namely using our physical environment to reduce our mental load. And this, in turn, helps us achieve more complex cognitive tasks. The complication is, if technology is truly making us cleverer, turning us into efficient information processing machines, why do we spend so much time feeling dumb? Last year, brain rot was named Oxford University Press's Word of the Year, a term that captures both the specific feelings of mindlessness that descends when we spend too much time scrolling through rubbish online and the corrosive, aggressively dumb content itself, the nonsense memes and the AI garble. When we hold our phones, we have, in theory, most of the world's accumulated knowledge at our fingertips. So why do we spend so much time dragging our eyeballs over dreck? One issue is that our digital devices have not been designed to help us think more efficiently and clearly. Almost everything we encounter online has been designed to capture and monetize our attention. To extend Christodoulou's metaphor, in the same way that one feature of an obesogenic society is food deserts, whole neighborhoods in which you cannot buy a healthy meal, large parts of the internet are information deserts in which the only available brain food is junk. It is into this climate that generative AI arrived with an entirely novel offer. Until recently, you could only outsource remembering and some data processing to technology. Now you can outsource thinking itself. Given that we spend most of our lives feeling overstimulated and frazzled, it's little wonder that so many have jumped at the chance to let a computer do more things we would have once done for ourselves, such as write work reports or emails or plan a holiday. As we transition from the internet era to the AI era, what we're consuming is not only ever more low-value, ultra-processed information, but more information that is essentially pre-digested, delivered in a way that is designed to bypass important human functions, such as assessing, filtering, and summarizing information, or actually considering a problem rather than finessing the first solution presented to us. A few years ago, Matt Miles, a psychology teacher at a high school in Virginia, was sent on a training program on tech in schools. The teachers were shown a video in which a schoolgirl is caught checking her phone during lessons. In the video, she looks up and says, "You think I'm just on TikTok or playing games? I'm actually in a research room talking to a water researcher from Botswana for a project." It's laughable. You show it to the kids and they all laugh, right? Miles said. Alarmed at the disconnect between how policymakers view tech in education and what teachers were seeing in the classroom, in 2017, Miles and his colleague, Joe Clement, who teaches economics and government at the same school, published Screen Schooled, about a book that argued that technology overuse is making kids dumber. In the years since, smartphones have been banned from their classrooms, but students still work from their laptops. We had one kid tell us, and I think it was pretty insightful, "If you see me on my phone, there's a 0% chance I'm doing something productive. If you see me on my laptop, there's a 50% chance," Miles said. Until the pandemic, many teachers were rightly skeptical about the benefits of introducing more technology into the classroom. Faith Boninger, a researcher at the University of Colorado, observes, "But when lockdowns forced schools to go online, a new normal was created, and ed tech platforms such as Google Workspace for Education, Kahoot, and Zern became ubiquitous. With the spread of generative AI came new promises that it could revolutionize education and usher in an era of personalized student learning, while also reducing the workload for teachers. But almost all the research that has found benefits to introducing tech in classrooms is funded by the ed tech industry, and most large-scale independent research has found that screen time gets in the way of achievement. A global OECD study found, for instance, that the more students use tech in schools, the worse their results. There is simply no independent evidence at scale for the effectiveness of these tools. In essence, what is happening with these technologies is we're experimenting on children," says Wayne Holmes, a professor of critical studies of artificial intelligence and education at the University College London. Most sensible people would not go into a bar and meet somebody who says, "Hey, I've got this new drug, it's really good for you," and just use it. Generally, we expect our medicines to be rigorously tested. We expect them to be prescribed to us by professionals. But suddenly, when we're talking about EdTech, which apparently is very beneficial for children's developing brains, we don't need to do that. What worries Miles and Clement is not only that their students are permanently distracted by their devices, but also that they will not develop critical thinking skills and deep knowledge when quick answers are only a click away. Where once Clement would ask his class a question such as, "Where do you think the U.S. ranks in terms of GDP per capita?" and guide his students as they puzzled over the solution. Now someone would have Googled the answer before he's even finished his question. They know students use ChatGPT constantly and get annoyed if they aren't provided with a digital copy of their assignment, because then they must type rather than copy and paste the relevant questions into an AI assistant or the Google search bar. Being able to Google something and providing the right answer isn't knowledge, Clement said. And having knowledge is incredibly important, so that when you hear something that's questionable or maybe fake, you think, "Wait a minute, that contradicts all the knowledge I have that says otherwise, right?" It's no wonder there's a bunch of idiots walking about who think that the Earth is flat. Like if you read a Flat Earth blog, you think, "Ah, that makes a lot of sense," because you don't have any understanding or knowledge. The internet is already awash with conspiracy and misinformation, something that will only become worse as AI hallucinates and produces plausible fakes. And he worries that young people are poorly equipped to navigate it. During the pandemic, Miles says, he found his young son weeping over his school-issued tablet. His son was doing an online math program, and he had been tasked with making 6 using the fewest number of 1, 3, and 5 tokens. He kept suggesting using 2 threes, and the computer kept telling him he was wrong. Miles tried 1 and 5, which the computer accepted. "That's kind of the nightmare you get with a non-human AI, right?" Miles observes. Students often approach topics in unanticipated and interesting ways, but machines struggle to cope with idiosyncrasy. Listening to his story, however, I was struck by a different kind of nightmare. Maybe the dawn of the new golden era of stupidity doesn't begin when we submit to superintelligent machines. It starts when we hand over power to dumb ones. This was adapted from an article that first appeared in The Guardian. And we'll read one of the obituaries this week. The vice president who led the war on terror, Dick Cheney, 1941 to 2025. Dick Cheney turned the vice presidency from a punchline into a powerhouse, having been a right-hand man to multiple Republican presidents before running with George W. Bush in 2000. He knew his worth. When a former Veep, Dan Quayle, warned him the job mostly involved attending meetings and funerals, Cheney replied, "I have a different understanding with the president." A proponent of a strong executive branch, he rejected the idea that protecting civil liberties outweighed the imperative to prevent another 9/11. Instead, he became the architect of the war on terror, crafting and promoting the administration's rationale for invading Iraq in 2003. That conflict, in which nearly 5,000 U.S. service members and some 200,000 Iraqi civilians were killed, grew increasingly unpopular once it became clear that Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein did not have weapons of mass destruction. Janie, though, professed no regrets and didn't even object to being portrayed as a behind-the-scenes Machiavelli. "Am I the evil genius in the corner that nobody ever sees come out of his hole?" he mused in 2004. It's a nice way to operate, actually. Richard Bruce Janie was born in Lincoln, Nebraska, and spent his adolescence in Casper, Wyoming. His parents, both Democrats, boasted that their son had been born on Franklin Roosevelt's birthday, said USA Today. In high school, Dick was captain of the football team. His future wife, Lynn Ann Vincent, was homecoming queen and won a scholarship to Yale University. But he dropped out and floundered for a time, racking up 2 drunk driving arrests before starting political science classes at the University of Wyoming in the mid-1960s. By the end of the decade, he was working for an up-and-coming staffer in the Nixon White House named Donald Rumsfeld, who had become his mentor. In the Ford administration, 34-year-old Cheney was named the youngest chief of staff in history when Rumsfeld left the post. He had his first heart attack, he'd had 5, at 37 while running for the U.S. House, where he spent 10 years. When President George H.W. Bush nominated him for Secretary of Defense, he was unanimously confirmed despite questions over his multiple draft deferrals. "I had other priorities in the 60s than military service," he said. Cheney won plaudits for low-key but firm leadership, said the Wall Street Journal, a style that helped him form an international coalition to oust Iraqi troops from Kuwait in the first Gulf War. When the next President Bush wanted a seasoned Washington insider on his ticket, he asked Cheney to compile a list of VP candidates. Cheney did, but then selected himself. Cheney's defining moment arrived on September 11, 2001, said the New York Times. The planes hit when Bush was away in Florida. Cheney quickly ordered that any other hijacked plane be shot down, which proved unnecessary, and persuaded Bush to authorize enhanced interrogation or torture of terrorist suspects, including waterboarding, sleep deprivation, and rectal force feeding. A powerful advocate for the invasions of Afghanistan in October 2001, in Iraq in March 2003, he insisted there was no doubt Saddam was stockpiling WMDs and that U.S. troops would be greeted as liberators. Events would prove Cheney wrong, said the Washington Post. The Iraq conflict birthed insurgencies and extremism, and photographs of detainees tortured at Abu Ghraib prison drew global condemnation. By Bush's second term, Cheney found himself increasingly sidelined. His nadir came in 2006, when he accidentally blasted a hunting buddy in the face with birdshot. Yet though the U.S. was poorer, weaker, more divided, and less globally popular when he left office in 2009, said Foreign Policy, it also had not suffered another 9/11-like attack. Out of office, Cheney was one of the most strident GOP critics of President Barack Obama, whom he saw as weak, said CNN.com. Though Cheney endorsed Donald Trump as GOP presidential nominee in 2016, he broke with Trump after the January 6, 2021 U.S. Capitol riot. After his daughter, then Representative Liz Cheney, helped investigate Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 election, Trump pushed supporters to oust her and fantasized about her facing a firing squad. Cheney stood with his daughter and, in an ironic coda, voted for Democrat Kamala Harris in 2024. "There has never been an individual who is a greater threat to our republic than Donald Trump," he said. "He can never be trusted with power again." I'm going to read one of the science shorts. Ancient monster of a black hole. Astronomers using the James Webb Space Telescope have found an ancient supermassive black hole with a mass about 100 million times that of the sun, a discovery that could help explain how such black holes grew so quickly in the early universe. Nicknamed BIRD, short for Big Red Dot, the black hole existed around 4 billion years ago, around 4 billion years after the Big Bang, during a period known as cosmic noon. Its light has been traveling toward Earth for 10 billion years. Although it appears very bright in infrared, BIRD is oddly absent from X-ray and radio surveys, an anomaly that suggests it may be cloaked in thick layers of dust and gas that trap high-energy radiation while allowing infrared light to escape. BIRD appears to belong to a mysterious class of compact objects known as little red dots, believed to be seed black holes still buried in their dusty cocoons. But it is much bigger than any of those. Study leader Federica Locono says the plan now is to examine little red dots closer to Earth, which can be studied in greater detail. With its ability to see so far that it has effectively peering into the distant past, the James Webb Telescope has opened a new frontier in extragalactic astrophysics, revealing objects we didn't even suspect existed, she tells Space.com. And we're only at the beginning of this adventure. And we'll pick up one of the Talking Points articles. Mamdani, why he won, and can he succeed? Zoran Mamdani's victory last week has triggered a political earthquake, said Mara Gay in the New York Times, and its aftershocks will reverberate far beyond New York City. The city's charismatic new mayor-elect energized a Democratic Party that has seemed paralyzed by inaction in the Trump era, overcoming deep skepticism from party leaders and Islamophobic attacks from opponents to defeat disgraced former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who ran as an independent. Powered by confidence, joy, and expert use of social media, the 34-year-old Democratic socialist and Muslim immigrant relentlessly focused on affordability, with promises of fare-free city buses, universal child care, and a rent freeze for 2 million rent-stabilized apartments. His insistence that housing and child care are basic needs that should not be beyond anyone's reach resonated with young people, people of color, and even upper-middle-class whites struggling with the city's stratospheric cost of living. What began as a race about affordability became a campaign for human dignity. Mamdani's win brings many troubling implications, said John R. Puri in National Review. As an avowed enemy of capitalism, we'll soon run the world's financial capital, and an anti-Zionist crusader will be charged with protecting the country's largest population of Jews from anti-Semitic violence. Mamdani's socialist agenda would make New York less livable, less secure, and less prosperous. Mamdani will also be hard-pressed to fulfill his ambitions and expensive promises, said Juliet Chung in the Wall Street Journal. He says he'll fund universal child care, estimated to cost about $6 billion, by boosting the city's income tax from 3.88% to 5.88% for New Yorkers earning over $1 million a year, and by raising the state's corporate tax rate from 7.25% to 11.5%, on top of the city's corporate rate of 8.85%. His ability to execute depends heavily on buy-in from state lawmakers, and Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul has already said she opposes raising taxes. New Yorkers have had their hopes set incredibly high, said Adam Gavitt in The Guardian, and it remains to be seen how much patience they'll have as Mamdani settles into office. But this campaign invigorated many New Yorkers like never before, and so he goes into battle with a strong base of support. He has rejuvenated the left and has shown the National Democratic establishment that there is clearly an appetite for the party to do something different. And some of the short notes. Coast Guard runs stores in Washington, D.C. and Virginia, which sell tax-free goods to service members and their families, now stock Trump-branded wine and cider. The brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are pleased to be able to buy Trump wine and cider tax-free, said a Homeland Security official. The number of military veterans designated 100% disabled by the Department of Veterans Affairs and so eligible for tax-free payments of $50,000 a year and benefits, including free health care, has increased nearly ninefold since 2021 to about 1.5 million. That rise has coincided with a boom in for-profit consultants who charge vets up to $20,000 in fees to coach them in how to qualify for the benefit and sometimes urge them to stretch the truth. Plastic surgeons in Washington, D.C. are seeing a surge in requests for Mar-a-Lago face treatments from Trump World insiders. Women are requesting fillers, especially for lips, said surgeon Anita Kulkarni. Men are getting Botox, liposuction, and eyelid rejuvenation to appear younger and more virile and masculine, said surgeon Troy Bittman. On the poll watch, 74% of adults believe Congress should extend the Affordable Care Act subsidies that Republicans cut in their budget, including 94% of Democrats, 76% of independents, and 50% of Republicans. And we will close out the show with a quote from John Stuart Mill, quoted in The Depaulia. He says, "The mental and moral, like the muscular powers, are improved only by being used." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Please join us again next time. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.